This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, a COVID and counterterrorism update in sub-Saharan Africa. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. What is the status of the coronavirus pandemic in large swaths of the continent? The BBC quotes the Africa Centers for Disease Control as saying that at least 40 countries have seen a second wave of the pandemic, including all countries in the southern region. The African CDC attributes the new wave of infections to the emergence of variants that are more transmissible, particularly the one in South Africa. Elsewhere in Africa, this variant has also been officially recorded in Botswana, Ghana, Kenya, Comoros, Zambia, Mozambique, and Tanzania. According to the World Health Organization, much of the continent benefits from COVAX, a global risk-sharing mechanism for pooled procurement and equitable distribution of COVID-19 vaccines. In addition, we will examine the pace and progress of the vaccination campaign and find out where there may be pockets of skepticism or resistance. Given the pandemic's devastating impact on critical revenue-generating sectors like tourism, agriculture, and manufacturing, we will assess prospects for an economic comeback in parts of the continent. Also, are some countries continuing to use the pretext of COVID-19 to suppress civil liberties, delay elections, and crack down on political opponents? On the counterterrorism front, how and why has the ISIS-affiliated jihadist group Al-Sunna wa Jama'a, which operates under the banner of ISCAP, the Islamic State Central Africa Province, grown so influential in the gas-rich northern Mozambican province of Cabo Delgado? According to the Sufan Center, the Biden administration has become so concerned about the strength of jihadist groups in sub-Saharan Africa that it has designated ISCAP as a foreign terrorist organization. U.S. Green Berets are currently engaged in a modest training exercise of Mozambican Marines. In late March, ISCAP carried out a major attack in the coastal town of Palma in Cabo Delgado, which forced out at least 11,000 people. According to UNHCR, dozens of people reportedly were killed by Islamist militants. 3 years of turmoil and violence in northern Mozambique has displaced nearly 700,000 inside the country. What are the roots of this insurgency, and to what extent has the Mozambican central government's alleged mismanagement of newfound gas reserves and its security services' heavy-handed approach to putting down the insurgency, including human rights violations and harassment of civilians and journalists, fueled local grievances and support for the insurgency? For more on these interrelated topics, we are joined by Gabrielle Steinhauser, Deputy Bureau Chief for Africa at the Wall Street Journal. Ms. Steinhauser writes about politics and economics in Southern Africa and beyond, and helps manage the Wall Street Journal's Reporters on the Continent. And John Temin, he's director of the Africa Program at Freedom House, overseeing the organization's efforts to advance democracy and human rights across the continent. And John previously worked on the U.S. State Department's policy planning staff and served as director of the Africa Program at the U.S. Institute of Peace. Gabrielle Steinhauser joins us from Johannesburg via Microsoft Teams. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you. Thank you for having me.
And John Temin joins us from Washington. John, welcome to you.
Thanks, Carol. Good to be here.
Well, let's begin with Gabrielle in Johannesburg. Gabrielle, looking at the impact of the COVID pandemic, what are you seeing in South Africa where we know there was a rather potent variant? Are you seeing some progress? How would you characterize the situation?
Yeah, we're actually going through a really nice moment at the moment where cases have been down for a couple of months now, but we're all bracing ourselves for the impact of the long weekend over Easter, where a lot of people went home, saw family, traveled, tried to, you know, catch a few last moments at the beach. And we're going to wait and see what happens in 2 weeks. But we had a horrible Christmas, horrible New Year season, a really, really bad second wave with many deaths. And we're hoping that we're not going to get a very bad third wave. But I think a lot of people are expecting that, unfortunately.
What about the vaccination campaign? Has that begun in earnest in South Africa in particular? And are you detecting any so-called vaccine hesitancy
So we've had a very limited rollout so far. There's a kind of an extended clinical trial rollout of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine to healthcare workers. And I think we've reached between 20 and 25% of healthcare workers, so fewer than 300,000 people so far. So there's no large-scale rollout. There's going to be more vaccines coming as of May when some vaccinations will be opened up to people over 60, but we're definitely not seeing a vaccination effect here at all.
So turning to you, John Tamman, I'd like to get your sense of both the impact of the pandemic on the continent and any specific countries you'd like to single out, as well as the vaccination campaign. Of course, poor countries, and particularly in sub-Saharan Africa, they're usually the last to be able to take advantage of progress. We know the vaccines are finally arriving, but we're seeing some problems in their distribution, particularly in the DRC. What are you seeing?
Well, I think it's hard to draw big conclusions across the continent because the continent is so diverse, but also because data and information can be so limited. And the numbers of deaths, certainly in Africa, have been lower than in other parts of the world, thankfully. But there's also some questions about the strength of reporting of those deaths and how accurate some of those numbers may be. So it's hard to get the clear picture. One thing I would point to, Carol, is the way that the pandemic is affecting a lot of other things. And that includes democracy and human rights issues that I focus a lot on. And we've seen a number of leaders and governments really abuse the pandemic in their interests and use the pretext of COVID response to protect their own interests and protect their own political fortunes. And that's something that we at Freedom House have paid a lot of attention to and have been concerned about. It can be difficult to understand where to draw the line between appropriate health responses and responses that go past what's appropriate and move into some of the more political realm. But I think in a few cases, you can certainly see that. Countries like Zimbabwe and Uganda come to mind in particular.
Speaking of Zimbabwe, Gabrielle, do you have anything to add to that situation with respect to how the COVID pandemic is being used as a pretext by some leaders to clamp down? In particular, in Zimbabwe, we are seeing clampdown on the opposition party by the government, and even the United States has talked about maintaining sanctions on the government because of that.
Yeah, I'm not sure if in Zimbabwe in particular, the policy or approach has really changed that much because of the pandemic. I mean, they had very few qualms about cracking down even before the pandemic. But what we've certainly seen in Zimbabwe is also a very, very bad second wave driven by the South African variant. With lots of people getting sick, lots of people not getting appropriate medical care or even testing. There's obviously been a pretty long lockdown there that is currently being eased. And, you know, they're starting to vaccinate people with the Sinopharm vaccine. But we're certainly not seeing some kind of moment of democracy in the middle of a pandemic that does make it easier for governments to crack down and arrest people. But I don't see a big link in Zimbabwe specifically with the pandemic, because it's certainly been an approach that has been the dominant one for several years.
Indeed. It's just another factor that they can use to justify the unjustifiable. So back to you, John. I wonder if you could talk about any of the other countries, particularly in West Africa, Ivory Coast or Mali. Are you seeing trends on the political front or economic front by the same token?
Well, we're definitely seeing democratic backsliding in a number of countries, but West Africa is rather pronounced now. And I should back up and just preface all this with saying we're seeing democratic backsliding across the world. And that's what our Freedom of the World report recently released documents, the 15th consecutive year of democratic backsliding and regression in terms of freedom. So Africa is far from alone in that regard. But West Africa really has had a rough few years on these issues. And West Africa previously performed relatively well in terms of democratic governance and human rights. But we're seeing the regression in several countries, and you named a few of them. Some of it is related to term limit challenges. This past year, we saw the leaders of Guinea and Cote d'Ivoire engineer through one way or another another third terms for themselves, which is problematic. We saw a coup in Mali, which was deeply problematic. And we've seen countries that have done well in terms of democratic governance, such as Benin, really regress. Benin has an election coming up this weekend, which effectively will not include opposition parties, and that's very concerning. So the overall trends, especially in West Africa, are problematic. Other countries have been declining as well. Tanzania is right up there, and as is Mozambique, and I know we're going to talk more about that. So the democratic picture in Africa is difficult. There are important exceptions. Sudan is making some real progress amidst the tentative opening there, and Malawi made a really impressive turnaround last year. But as with the rest of the world, it's a difficult picture right now.
Well, turning back to you, Gabriel, I wanted to pick up on this democratic backsliding and ask you about China's influence, particularly in Southern Africa and what is called, you know, vaccine diplomacy. China has been involved in Africa for so many years now. It has really encroached on the continent, looking for economic benefit, raw materials. And some people are worried, particularly the democracies and the United States in particular, about its influence in bolstering this unfortunate trend to which John referred, you know, democratic backsliding. And then through its vaccine diplomacy, so to speak, that it may be reinforcing that, you know, providing vaccines and other supplies. Are you seeing that trend?
I would say that I don't think China is per se pursuing a policy of, you know, encouraging countries not to be democratic. I think that what a lot of African politicians like about China is that they have kind of an approach where there's less pressure to follow democratic rules and human rights. So I think it's more in that direction. I think with the vaccine diplomacy, I think it's true. We have definitely seen a lot of African countries receiving Chinese vaccines with great fanfare. And earlier in the pandemic, a lot of them received PPE and other medical equipment at a time when it was very, very hard to get by. And I think if the US and other Western countries are worried about that, and some have expressed concern, the best thing would be to kind of start with themselves and look at why the big Western-led effort to distribute vaccines across the continent, the COVAX facility, hasn't really performed in the same way and has actually been quite slow to roll out vaccines. And, you know, we've seen big Western countries not exporting vaccines, very much prioritizing their own populations. I'm seeing every day how, you know, in the US, a lot of young people are now getting their vaccine, and that's great. Obviously, the US has had a very horrible and hard pandemic, but it can be jarring watching that from this part of the world when, you know, really the people at the front lines who are risking their lives, health workers, are still waiting to get their shots, and old people and other people who are very much at risk. So I think from a PR and global hearts and minds campaign, that isn't helping.
That's a good point. Well, so back to you, John Temin, you know, notwithstanding what we're seeing in countries like the Democratic Republic of Congo, where 1.7 million doses may expire, go unused, where there's some vaccine hesitancy, even among health workers. Aside from that, what would you say about what is being called China's vaccine diplomacy and the fact that it really has provided vaccines for the continent, you know, help, and in that way has endeared some of these more autocratic countries to China? And that could really affect more backsliding in terms of democracy and human rights, because we know China is no paragon of virtue or democratic and human rights.
Well, when it comes to the vaccines specifically, I think China is showing up where others aren't. And it's hard to be critical of that. And it's hard to criticize any country that chooses to take the vaccines that are in front of them. And the fact is that the West is not showing up in the same way right now and is not offering vaccines in the same magnitude. And that's a situation that I hope is going to change. And, you know, I think similar to what Gabrielle is saying, I wouldn't put too much emphasis on the Chinese factor as it relates to democracy and human rights. It certainly is a factor, but I think the factors that we see in terms of both progress and decline in Africa are a lot more homegrown. China offers a model that is appealing to some, a model of prioritizing economic growth over rights and governance. And that can be appealing, particularly to leaders who want to stay in power. And it can be appealing to some citizens who share that prioritization. But I don't think that's a prioritization that lots of people share. And I think when you look at public survey data in Africa, democracy is still far and away the most popular system of governance. But, you know, leaders and citizens are not always given a choice between whether it's vaccines or funding for infrastructure projects or loans or other things. And there are more times currently that China shows up with these things, and leaders sometimes take that option.
You're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. Joining me via Microsoft Teams are Gabrielle Steinhauser, Deputy Bureau Chief for Africa at the Wall Street Journal, and John Temin, from whom you just heard. He's Director of the Africa Program at Freedom House here in Washington. And this is our periodic update on Africa. We are focusing on the social and political impact of COVID-19 and counterterrorism challenges. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel VOA. Here's a shout out to a loyal Twitter follower, Rahman Solio from Osun in southwestern Nigeria. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. So back to you, Gabrielle Steinhauser, with your finger on the pulse in southern Africa. I want to turn now to the Cabo Delgado province in Mozambique, talking about the recent terrible attack in Palma by this ISIS-affiliated group. But it wasn't always that way. I wonder if you could just remind us of the roots of this insurgency in northern Mozambique and Cabo Delgado, where there have been grievances and economic inequities, especially in the wake of the discovery and development of liquefied natural gas reserves. Where did things go wrong? And how did it morph into this internationally affiliated Islamist group?
The best starting point for looking at this insurgency in Cabo Delgado is to actually look at a map and see where Cabo Delgado is. And it's very, very far away from Maputo, the capital, you know, where the government sits and where a lot of the elites and the money in Mozambique is located. And Cabo Delgado has always been a province that's been forgotten a little bit, that is far away and poorer than the rest of the country. Literacy levels are much lower. And at the same time, in recent years, they have been big discoveries of natural resources, like you mentioned, the gas fields just offshore that are some of the biggest, certainly in that region. And there's also rubies that are being mined by big companies. So you're having these very radical contrasts. On the one hand, these sort of major sources of potential riches for the government and Mozambique, and then abject poverty right next to it, plus the consequences for the local populations going after some of these resources, dislocations, and lack of opportunity. And I think that's really where this all started. And then we kind of dial back the clock to October 2017, when we saw a group of armed men storm the town of Mocimboa del Praia. They attacked some police stations, and it was sort of seen as the first Islamist attack in southern Africa, and it raised some eyebrows. And there was certainly concern, but I don't think anybody at that moment would have thought that it would take us where we are now, 3.5 years later, confronting an insurgency that many people are comparing with, you know, what we saw with Boko Haram in Nigeria a few years ago.
Yes, indeed. And also I've seen comparisons to the attack from the ISIS-affiliated group AQIM in Algeria back in 2013. Well, over to you, John. I don't know whether you want to comment on the conditions that led to this horrific attack that we just witnessed and the other attacks in the past several years by the ISIS-affiliated group in Cabo Delgado. Or also, you may want to talk about the countries in the Sahel where we're still grappling with instability because of terrorist networks in Burkina Faso, of course, Mali and Chad.
Thanks, Carol. Let me make two broad points in relation to extremism, both in Mozambique and in some of the other situations you referenced. One is that, as Gabrielle was saying, many of these stories do relate to service delivery and the government's ability to provide for citizens and support citizens in remote areas. And in many of these situations, we've seen that the government struggles to do that is almost not present in these areas, and citizens are left on their own. And citizens often see corruption in other parts of the countries and corruption at the highest levels of government, and that really adds to frustration. Second point is that we need to keep a close eye on the government's security response and what security services do, because what we've seen time and again is that when the security response is excessive and heavy-handed and brutal, it is very counterproductive, and it can even drive people into the arms of extremists, and it can make people just as afraid of their own security services as they are of the extremists. And there's a real tendency for security services to overdo it. And I think that's something we need to watch out for closely in Mozambique, because we've seen that happen in quite a number of other countries as well.
Back to you, Gabriel Steinhauser, because I think John makes a very good point, especially with regard to Cabo Delgado and the government in Maputo has been accused of heavy-handed tactics. How do you see things going forward? Is there a realization in Maputo, in the central government? And of course, we know that the French, because of Total, the gas company, and the United States having sent green berets. I mean, there's this international recognition that this is a very serious problem, probably very late in the game, as always, because of the factors that John mentioned should have been wake-up calls, inequities and other grievances, economic. But how do you see Mozambique going forward in getting a handle on this insurgency, as well as managing its newfound wealth?
I think what is very clear is that the answer to this cannot just be a military one. It is obvious that the Mozambican security forces have been overwhelmed, that, as you said, they have been heavy-handed and brutal, and they certainly haven't been able to match, you know, what is ultimately still a relatively low level force of people armed with, you know, AK-47s and some rocket propelled grenades. So it is clear that they do need some military backup, but just by sending in troops or planes or drones, like we've seen elsewhere, you're not going to win this war, because you have to win over the people on the ground. And what I'm hearing over and over again when I'm talking to sources is the thing that, you know, the Mozambican security forces are lacking is intelligence. Time and time again, they're being taken aback by these attacks and don't know how to respond because they're not being informed by people on the ground about what's going on.
Well, we're going to be watching this development very closely and trying to bring more analysis and reporting about it. But one more question to you, Gabrielle, before I let you go. Let's circle back to economic impact, because I think you both alluded to the fact that economic inequities help to fuel these kinds of insurgencies, and then they're exploited by groups, Islamist groups like ISIS, et cetera, as the continent's coping with COVID. Are you seeing any bright spots with respect to economic recovery, or are you seeing that this is going to be a major setback, Gabrielle?
There is an economic recovery, but it's slow and it's weak and it's uneven. And yes, we're not, you know, in the same kind of lockdown that we were a year ago, where, you know, I think more than 40% of Black households in South Africa ran out of food in the month of April. So we're not in that situation, because frankly, the government can't afford it, even if there was another bad wave. But for instance, in South Africa, the economy shrank 7% last year, and they're looking at 3% growth this year. So it's going to take a long time to get back to even where we were in 2019. And that is true for a lot of other countries in the region. The fact that a lot of these countries depend on tourism, for example, as a major source of revenue. And, you know, during a time where there's no broad vaccination across Southern Africa and a lot of other African countries, tourists from Europe, tourists from the US are going to be very reluctant to come and visit. And, you know, many times their governments won't allow them. And that's going to create problems for many years, unfortunately.
And John, I'm going to give you the last word, because economics and politics are very much intertwined.
Well, as it concerns the economy, it's hard to find too many bright spots amidst a pandemic, and especially given the fact that vaccinations are unfortunately taking longer in Africa than they are elsewhere. I think debt relief has been and will continue to be a big part of the economic conversation and what forms of additional debt relief can be provided amidst a pandemic. One small bright spot is perhaps in Sudan, where they are making progress on debt relief, and the U.S. has made some important contributions to that process recently. Sudan overall is still a place where there's some cautious optimism about the political transition that's going on there. It's tenuous, but there's reason for hope if things break in the right direction. But overall, I think the recovery is going to take some time. What I would look at in particular is, as the recovery unfolds, how are the benefits of that recovery being shared across society? And are those benefits reaching the poorest people and people outside of the capital? Because there may be a tendency for some of those benefits to accumulate to the wealthy and to those who are in some of the centers of power. So I'll be keeping an eye out for that.
I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guest, Gabrielle Steinhauser. She's Deputy Bureau Chief for Africa at the Wall Street Journal, based in Johannesburg, and John Temin, Director of the Africa Program at Freedom House. Encounter was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Rick Pantaleo. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.